The Rolling Stones were the most fantastic group operating in the country tonight. Rick and Carlo are two of the best. Audience was changed from last week, which is the main thing. Money not quite so exciting, £8. Still, should rise steam now. Rick and Carlo. Carlo Little was a butcher, a killing drummer, great energy. And Ricky Fenson on bass, a lovely player. They had bleached their hair blonde for the gig. And who did they really work for? Screaming Lord effing such. From time to time, they'd sit in with us. That's when Charlie still wasn't with us, and it's why he decided to join the band, because he heard we had this red-hot rhythm section. Ricky and Carlo, if they went into a solo, they would go into Turbo Max. The room would take off. They almost blew us off the stage, they were so good, the two of them together. When Carlo set into that bass drum, this is what I'm talking about. This was rock and roll. As a kid, to play with these guys, who were only 2 or 3 years older than we were, but they had been at it a long time, was something. The first time they took me in there, okay, goes like this, and I suddenly had this rhythm section behind me. Whoa! That was the first time I got 3 feet off the ground and into the stratosphere. This was before I was working with Charlie and Bill or anything. And from the earliest, I always felt good on stage. You get nervous before you go up there before a lot of people, but to me the feeling was, let the tiger out the cage. Maybe that's just another version of butterflies, it could be. But I've always felt very comfortable on stage, even if I screw up. It always felt like a dog. This is my turf. Piss around it. While I'm here, nothing else can happen. All I can do is screw up. Otherwise, have a good time. Next day is the first mention of Charlie playing with us. Tuesday 15. All group money to be given up for at least 2 weeks to buy amp and mics. Ealing, Charlie. Maybe due to my cold, but didn't sound right to me. But then Mick and Brian and myself still groggy from chills and fever. Charlie swings, but hasn't got right sound yet. Rectify that tomorrow. Poor crowd, no money, chucking it. Have a day off. Rick and Carlo to play Saturday and Monday. So Charlie was coming in. We were going to try and figure out how to separate Bill from the amplifier and still end up winning. But at the same time, Bill and Charlie were starting to play together, and there was something happening here. Bill is an incredible bass player, there's no doubt about it. I discovered it gradually. Everybody was learning. Nobody had any firm ideas of what they wanted to do, and everybody came from a slightly different background. Charlie was a jazz man. Bill was from the Royal Air Force. At least he'd been abroad. Charlie Watts has always been the bed that I lie on musically, and to see that note about how to rectify his sound seems extraordinary. But like Stu, Charlie had come to rhythm and blues because of its jazz connection. A few days later, I write, Charlie swings very nicely, but can't rock. Fabulous guy, though. He had not got rock and roll down at that time. I wanted him to hit it a little harder. He was still too jazz for me. We knew he was a great drummer, but in order to play with the Stones, Charlie went and studied Jimmy Reed and Earl Phillips, who was the drummer for Jimmy Reed, just to get the feel of it. That sparse, minimalized thing. And he's always retained it. Charlie was the drummer we wanted. But first off, could we afford him? And second off, would he give up some of his jazz ways for us? Tuesday, 22nd. £0. Ealing. Charlie. Cock up number 2. Only 2 people turned up by 8:50, so we went home. Nevertheless, we did a couple of numbers, one using maracas, tambourine, and wailing guitar with Charlie doing a big jungle rhythm, which just shows he can do it. Stopped by cops on way to flat. Frisked. Moaning bastards. No more work until Saturday. The big jungle rhythm was the Bo Diddley lick. Shave and a haircut, two bits. It's what the beat's called, and what it sounds like. Bo diddly, have you heard? My pretty baby said she was a bird. As for the frisk, when I read that, I thought, even then? We had nothing, not even money. It's not surprising that when they hit on me for the real shit later, I knew about it. Frisked for no reason at all. And my reaction is still the same. Fucking moaning bastards. They always moan. You wouldn't be a cop if you weren't a moaner. Come on, assume the position. Back then, there was nothing to find. I was frisked 100 times before I even thought, oh my God, I've got something on me. Thursday, 24. No marquee. Cyril's scared of the applause we get, according to Carlo and Rick. Laid off for a month. If nothing shows up in the meantime, we'll go back. Spent day practicing. Worthwhile, I hope. Must preserve the finger style. Great opportunities, I feel. Bastard, though. Can't control them. Bleeding spider, feels like. Saturday, 26. 16 pounds. Ealing. Rick and Carlo. Band bit rusty. Quite good, though. Audience up. Sweaty and crowded. Lovely. 2 pounds. Lee was there. Funny. Can't seem to fit all my new practice dodgy bits into the act. Don't relax enough. Boy's a bit cynical lately. Monday, 28. Toss's sister said Lee was crazy to have me, but didn't want to make a fool of herself, and would I give her some help? I did fair, I reckon. Lee and I had broken up, and this was the rapprochement. Mutually agreed on both sides. Toss was short for Tosca, her girlfriend. Saturday 2, 16 pounds, Ealing, Charlie and Bill. Fabulous evening with big crowd. Sound returned with a bang, Charlie fabulous. By February 2, that night, we were playing with the final lineup and the rhythm section. Charlie and Bill. The Stones. If it hadn't been for Charlie, I would have never been able to expand and develop. Number one with Charlie is that he's got great feel. He had it then from the start. There's tremendous personality and subtlety in his playing. If you look at the size of his kit, it's ludicrous compared with what most drummers use these days. They've got a fort with them, an incredible barrage of drums. Charlie, with just that one classico setup, can pull it all off. Nothing pretentious, and then you hear him, and it don't half go bang. He plays with humor, too. I love to watch his foot through the perspex. Even if I can't hear him, I can play to him just by watching. The other thing is Charlie's trick that he got, I think from Jim Keltner or Al Jackson. On the hi-hat, most guys would play on all four beats, but on the 2 and the 4, which is the backbeat, which is a very important thing in rock and roll, Charlie doesn't play. He lifts up. He goes to play and pulls back. It gives the snare drum all of the sound, instead of having some interference behind it. It'll give you a heart arrhythmia if you look at it. He does some extra motion that's totally unnecessary. It pulls the time back because he has to make a little extra effort. And so part of the languid feel of Charlie's drumming comes from this unnecessary motion every 2 beats. It's very hard to do, to stop the beat going just for 1 beat and then come back in. And it also has something to do with the way Charlie's limbs are constructed, where he feels the beat. Each drummer's got a signature as to whether the hi-hat's a little bit ahead of the snare. Charlie's very far back with the snare, and up with the hi-hat. And the way he stretches out the beat, and what we do on top of that, is a secret of the Stone sound. Charlie's quintessentially a jazz drummer, which means the rest of the band is a jazz band in a way. He's up there with the best. Elvin Jones, Philly Joe Jones. He's got the feel, the looseness of it, and he's very economical. Charlie used to work weddings and bar mitzvahs, so he knows the schmaltz, too. It comes from starting early, playing the clubs, when he was really young. A little bit of showmanship, without himself being the showman. Ba-bam! And I've got used to playing with a guy like this. 40 years on, Charlie and I are tighter than we could express or even probably know. I mean, we even get daring enough to try and screw each other up sometimes on the stage. Back then, I used to rag Stu and Charlie wicked about jazz. We were supposed to be getting the blues down, and sometimes I'd catch Stu and Charlie listening to jazz on the sly. Stop that shit! I was just trying to break their habits, trying to put a band together, for Christ's sakes. You've got to listen to the blues. You've got to listen to fucking Muddy. I wouldn't even let them listen to Armstrong, and I love Armstrong. Bill always felt looked down upon, mainly because his real last name was Perks, and he was stuck in this dead-end job in South London, and he was married. Brian was very class-conscious, you see. Bill Perks, to him, was some lowlife. I wish we could find a new bass player. This one's a right fucking Ernie with his greasy hair, Felge remembers Brian saying. Bill was still a bit of a teddy boy at the time, with the quiff. But that was also superficial. Meanwhile, Brian was the king rat of the whole gang. By February, we were paying off higher purchase. I bought 2 guitars in the space of a month. January 25, day off. Buy a new guitar. Harmony or Hawk? Harmony has good price, but do you get guarantee? Hawk has, and also has case supplied. Both models, £84. Got 2 thumb picks. Bought Harmony with 2 pickups. Sunburst finish in 2-tone case, £74. Wednesday 13, February. Rehearsal. Got new Giddy from Ivor's. Lovely instrument. What a sound. New numbers. Who Do You Love and Route 66. Great. Revised Crawdaddy. Fabulous. All Brian's ideas. At least I give credit. And the venues were beginning to jump. Saturday 9, 1800. Amp payments due. Ealing. Collier's all-nighter? Crossed out. Must have been near record steaming hot and packed full. Band raved. Get real little girl fans there. £2. Stopped at flat. Paid Bill £6 for Vox. Monday 11, day off. Dead bored. The last 2 entries are the key to what was happening, all of a sudden. We were going to record, and we were about to take up the Richmond gig. Thursday 14, Manor House. Quite good. Small crowd. Blues by 6 frightened them all away. New Giddy takes some getting used to. New numbers went well. Stu says Glyn Johns will record us Monday or Thursday next week with ideas of selling them to Decca. £1. Friday 15, Red Lion. Can't get any sound out of this place. Punch up during session. Offered Richmond Hotel every Sunday from coming Sunday. Windfall. On the inside of the cover of the diary is written the phrase, Wong in the Pog. And next to that, under the personal notes section, in case of accident, please inform, I've written, my mum. No details. Wong in the Pog was when we'd look at all these people dancing around, hanging from rafters, going crazy. What are they doing? They're Wong in the Pog, ain't they? At least we got them Wong in the Pog. It meant you got paid. The gigs were getting tight and hot. We had this groundswell going on in London. When you've got 3 queues going around a whole damn block waiting to get into a show, you say, we've got something going here. This is no longer just begging. All we need to do now is nurture this thing. The spaces were small, which suited us. It suited Mick best of all. Mick's artistry was on display in these small venues, where there was barely space to swing a cat, perhaps more so than it ever was later. I think Mick's movements come a lot from the fact that we used to play these very, very small stages. With our equipment on stage, We'd sometimes have no more room than a table as a viable space to work. The band was 2 feet behind Mick. He was right in the middle of the band. There were no delay effects or separation, and because Mick was playing a lot of harmonica, he was part of the band. I can't think of any other singer at the time in England that played harp and was the lead singer, because the harp was, still can be, a very important part of the sound, especially when you're doing the blues. Give Mick Jagger a stage the size of a table, and he could work it better than anybody, except maybe James Brown. Twists and turns, and he's got the maracas going. Come on, baby. We used to sit on stools and play, and he would work around us because there was no room to move. You swung a guitar, you hit somebody else in the face. He used to play 4 maracas while he sang. It's a long time since I've reminded him about the maracas. He was brilliant. Even at that age, I was astounded by how he used that small space to do so much. It was like watching a Spanish dancer. Richmond is where we learned the gig. That's where we realized that we really did have a good band, and we could really release people for a few hours and get that reciprocation between the stage and the audience, because it's not an act, whatever Mick Jagger thinks. My favorite place, looking back, was the Station Hotel, Richmond, just because everything really kicked off from there. The Ricky Dick Club in Windsor was a damn good room to play. Eel Pie was fantastic because basically it was the same old crowd. They just moved around wherever we were playing. Giorgio Gomelski. There's another name that resonates from this period. Giorgio, who actually organized us, got us gigs in the Marquee and the Station Hotel. A very important person in the whole setup. A Russian immigrant, a great bear of a man, with incredible drive and enthusiasm. Brian led Giorgio to believe that he was the de facto manager of something that we didn't think needed managing. He did amazing things, put us up, got us gigs, but there was nothing more to promise at the time. It was just, we need gigs, spread the word. And Giorgio was very instrumental in that, very early on. He got booted out by Brian once Brian saw bigger things coming. Unbelievable how much Brian was the manipulator, thinking about these things. One had the feeling that Brian had made promises to people that nobody else had. So when the promises weren't delivered, we were all assholes. Brian was a bit free with Promised Land. Giorgio later became manager of the Yardbirds, including Eric Clapton, who were already picking up our spots. And then Eric left the Yardbirds and went away on a sabbatical for 6 months and came back as God, which he's still trying to live down. Mick has changed tremendously. Only thinking about this time do I remember with regrets how completely tight Mick and I were in the formation, the early years of the Stones. First off, we never had to question the aim. We were unerring in where we wanted to go, what it should sound like, so we didn't have to discuss it, just figure a way to do it. We didn't have to talk about the target. We knew what it was. It was basically just to be able to make records. The targets get bigger as things happen. Our first aim as the Rolling Stones was to be the best rhythm and blues band in London, with regular gigs every week. But the main aim was somehow to get to make records. To actually get into the portal, the Holy of Holies, the recording studio. How can you learn if you can't get in front of a microphone and a tape recorder in a studio? We saw this building up. And what's the next step? Make records, by hook or by crook. John Lee Hooker, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf. They were who they were. There was no compromise. They just wanted to make records, just like me. That's one of my connections with them all. I'll do anything to make a record. It was really narcissistic in a way. We just wanted to hear what we sounded like. We wanted the playback. The payback didn't come into it, but the playback we really wanted. In a way, in those days, being able to get into the studio and get an acetate back sort of legitimized you. You are now a commissioned officer, instead of being one of the ranks. Playing live was the most important thing in the world, but making records stamped it, signed, sealed, and delivered. Stu was the only guy that knew somebody that could actually open a door to a studio late at night and get an hour there. In those days, it was like going into Buckingham Palace or getting an entree into the Admiralty. It was nearly impossible to get into a recording studio. It's bizarre that now anybody can make a record anywhere and put it on the internet. Then it was like leaping over the moon, a mere dream. The first studio I actually went into was IBC in Portland Place, right across the road from the BBC. But of course there was no connection. With Glyn Johns, who happened to be an engineer there, and just wangled us some time. But that was just a one-gig thing. Then came the day that Andrew Lou Goldham came to see us play at Richmond, and things began to move at devastating speed. Within something like 2 weeks, we had a recording contract. Andrew had worked with Brian Epstein and was instrumental in creating the Beatles' image. Epstein fired Andrew because they got into some bitch argument. Andrew took a large step to the left and branched out on his own. Right, I'll show you. We were the instrument of his revenge on Epstein. We were the dynamite. Andy Oldham, the detonator. The irony is that Oldham, at the start, the great architect of the Stones' public persona, thought it was a disadvantage for us to be considered long-haired and dirty and rude. He was a very pristine boy himself at the time. The whole idea of the Beatles and the uniforms, keeping everything uniform, still made sense to Andrew. To us, it didn't. He put us in uniforms. We had those damn houndstooth, dogtooth check jackets on Thank Your Lucky Stars. But we just dumped them immediately and kept the leather waistcoats that he'd got us from Charing Cross Road. Where's your jacket? I don't know, my girlfriend's wearing it. And he did cotton on real quick to the fact that he'd have to go with it. What are you gonna do? The Beatles are all over the place like a fucking bag of fleas, right? And you've got another good band. The thing is not to try and regurgitate the Beatles. So we're gonna have to be the anti-Beatles. We're not gonna be the Fab Four, all wearing the same shit. And then Andrew started to play that to the hilt. Everybody's too cute and they all wear uniforms and it's all showbiz. And it was actually Andrew that disintegrated the way you can present yourself. Do everything wrong. At least from a showbiz Fleet Street point of view. Of course, we had no idea. We're too good for this shit, man. We're blues players, you know? At all of 18 years old. We've done Mississippi, been through Chicago. You kid yourself. But it was really flying into the face of it. And of course, the timing was dead right. You got the Beatles. Mums love them. Dads love them. But would you let your daughter marry this? And that was pretty much a stroke of genius. I don't think Andrew or any of us were geniuses. It was just a stroke that hit the mark. And once we had that down, it was okay. Now we can get into this game of show business and still be ourselves. I don't have to have the same haircut as him or him. I always looked at Andrew as the absolute PR man par excellence. I saw him as a sharp blade. I liked him a lot. Neurotic and sexually disoriented as he was. He'd been sent to a public school called Wellingboro, and at school in general, like me, he hadn't had a very good time. Andrew, especially in those days, was always a bit jittery, like crystal, but he was very, very sure of himself and what he should do, all the while with this certain fragility inside him. But he certainly put up a lot of front. I liked his mind. I liked the way he thought. And having done the art school bit and studied advertising, I saw the point immediately in what he was trying to do. We signed a deal with Decca, and days after that, getting paid to do this, we were in a studio in Denmark Street, Regent Sound Studio. It was just a little room full of egg boxes, and it had a Grundig tape recorder. And to make it look like a studio, the recorder was hung on the wall instead of put on the table. If it was on the table, it wasn't pro. But actually, what they did there was advertising jingles. Merry Mince, the too good to hurry mince. It was just a little jingle studio, very basic, very simple. And it made it easy for me to learn the bare bones of recording. One of the reasons we picked it was because it was mono, and what you hear is what you get. It was only a 2-track tape recorder. I learned how to overdub on it, by what they call ping-ponging, where you put the track that you just recorded onto one track, and then overdub. But of course you're losing generations by doing that sound-wise. You're letting the thing go through the mill one more time, and we found out that wasn't such a bad idea. So the first album, and a lot of the second, plus Not Fade Away, which was our first big chart climber at number 3 in February 1964, and Tell Me, were made surrounded by egg boxes. Those first albums were recorded at several studios with incredible people walking in, like Phil Spector, who played bass on Play With Fire, Jack Nitzsche playing harpsichord, Spector and Bo Diddley came around, and Gene Pitney, who recorded one of the first songs I wrote with Mick, That Girl Belongs to Yesterday. But the Decca deal meant that Stu had to be dropped from the band. 6 is too many, and the obvious odd one out is the piano player. That's the brutality of the business. It was Brian's task, since he called himself the leader of the band, to break it to Stu. It was a very hard thing. He wasn't surprised, and I think he'd already made his own decision about what he would do about it if it turned up. He understood it totally. We expected Stu to go, fuck you, thanks a lot. That was where the largeness of Stu's heart really displayed itself. From then on, okay, I'll drive you about. He was always on the records. He was only interested in the music. To us he was never fired, and he understood it totally. Don't look the same as you, do I? He had the largest heart in the world, man. He was instrumental in putting us together, and he wasn't about to let us drop because he was put in the background. The first single came out rapidly after signing the contract, everything moving in days, not weeks. It was a very deliberately commercial pitch, Come On by Chuck Berry. I didn't think it was the best thing we could have done, but I did know it was something that would make a mark. As a recording, it's probably better than I thought it was at the time, but I have a feeling we thought that that was the only shot we had in our locker then. It was not something that we ever played in the clubs. It was nothing to do with what we were doing. At the time, there was a purist strain running through the band, which I obviously was not on top of. I loved my blues, but I saw the potential of other things. And I also loved pop music. I quite cold-bloodedly saw this song as just a way to get in, to get into the studio and to come up with something very commercial. It's very different from Chuck Berry's version. It's very Beatle-ized, in fact. The way you could record in England, you couldn't get fussy. You went in and did it. I think everybody thought it stood a good shot. The band itself were like, we're making a record, can you believe this shit? There was also a sense of doom. Oh my God, if the single makes it, we've got 2 years and that's it. Then what are we going to do? Because nobody lasted. Your shelf life in those days, and a lot even now, was basically 2.5 years, and apart from Elvis, nobody had proved that wrong. The weird thing is that when that first record came out, we were still basically a club band. I don't think we'd played anything bigger than the Marquee. The record wormed its way into the top 20, and suddenly, in a matter of a week or so, we'd been transformed into pop stars. This is very difficult with a bunch of guys that are really like, get out of here, you know, fuck off. And suddenly they're dressing us up in dog-tooth check-fucking suits, and we're rushed along on the tide. It was like a tsunami. One minute, hey, you wanted to make a record. You've made a record, and it's in the goddamn top 20. And now you've got to do Thank Your Lucky Stars. TV you'd never thought about. We were propelled into show business. Because we were so anti-showbiz, it was the cold shoulder to us. Enough already. But then we realized that we did have to make certain concessions. Now we had to figure out how to work it. The jackets didn't last long. Maybe it was a good move for the first record, but by the second record, there was none of that. The crowds at the Crawdaddy Club had got so huge, Gomelski moved the club to the Athletic Ground, Richmond. July 1963, we actually moved out of London for a gig, for the first time ever, to Middlesbrough, Yorkshire. And the first taste of bedlam Between then and 1966, for 3 years, we played virtually every night, or every day, sometimes 2 gigs a day. We played well over 1,000 gigs, almost back to back, with barely a break and perhaps 10 days off in that whole period. Maybe if we'd been wearing our houndstooth jackets and looking like little dolls, we wouldn't have outraged the males in the audience at the Wisbech Corn Exchange in Cambridgeshire in July 1963. We were city boys, and this music is what's happening in the city. But you try playing Wisbech in 1963 with Mick Jagger. You got a totally different reaction. All of these hayseeds literally chewing on straw. The Wisbech Corn Exchange. Out in the goddamn marshes. And a riot was started because the local yokels, the boys, couldn't stand the fact that all of their chicks were gawping and blowing themselves out about this bunch of fags, as far as they were concerned, from London. By gum! That was a very good riot, which we were lucky to escape from. By the greatest contrast known to rock and roll audiences, the previous night we'd played a debutante ball at Hastings Caves for someone called Lady Lampson, all via Andrew Oldham. An awfully super-duper upper-crusty affair doing a low-life bash in Hastings Caves, which are quite big. And we were just part of the entertainment. We were told, when we were not working, to go into the catering area. That got our backs up. But we were playing it cool until one of them came up to Ian Stewart and said, "I say, piano chappie, can you play Moon River?" Bill decked him or took him out one way or another. Lord Lampson, or whoever it was at the time, said, "Who's that horrid little man? You can play at our parties, but we'll treat you like a black man." It was all right for me, I felt very proud. I mean, I love to be treated as black. But it was Stu that had to take the first remark. "I say, piano chappie." At first, our audiences were female-driven, until towards the end of the 60s, when it evened out. These armies of feral, body-snatching girls began to emerge in big numbers about halfway through our first UK tour in the fall of 1963. That was an incredible lineup. The Everly Brothers, Bo Diddley, Little Richard, Mickey Most. We felt like we were in Disneyland or the best theme park we could imagine. At the same time, we had this unique opportunity to check out the top cats. We used to hang from the rafters in the Gaumonts and the Odeons to watch Little Richard, Bo Diddley, and the Everlys at work. It was a 6-week tour. We went everywhere. Bradford, Cleethorpes, Albert Hall, Finsbury Park, big gigs, small gigs. There was that amazing feeling of, wow. I'm actually in a dressing room with Little Richard. One part of you is the fan, oh my God! And the other part of you is, you're here with the man, and now you better be a man. The first time we went up on that stage, at the New Victoria Theatre in London, it went to the horizon. The sense of space, the size of the audience, the whole scale, was breathtaking. We just felt so puny up there. Obviously, we weren't that bad. But we all looked at one another with shock. And the curtains opened and... Working the Coliseum. You get used to it pretty quick, you learn. But that first night, I felt so miniature. And of course we're not sounding like we usually are in a small room. Suddenly, we're sounding like little tin soldiers. There were so many things to learn real quick. That was the biggest deep end, really. We were probably disastrously horrible in some of those shows, but by then, there was a buzz going on. The audience was louder than we were, which certainly helped. Great backup vocals of chicks screaming. So in a way, we learned through this barrage of shrieking. Little Richard's stage presentation was outrageous and brilliant. You never knew which way he was going to arrive. He had the band thumping out Lucille for almost 10 minutes, which is a long time to keep that riff going. The whole place blacked out, nothing to see but the exit signs. And then he'd come out of the back of the theater. Other times he'd run on stage and then disappear again and come back. He had a different intro almost every time. What you realized was that Richard had checked the theater, talked to the lighting people. "Where can I come from? Is there a doorway up there?" and figured out how he could get the most effective intro possible. Whether it's bang, straight in, or whether to let the riff roll for 5 minutes and then turn up from the loft. Suddenly, you're not just playing a club, where presentation means nothing, where there's no room to move, no way of doing anything. Suddenly, to see stage work going on with Bo Diddley too, it was mind-blowing. Like you'd been elevated somehow by a miracle and allowed to talk to the gods. On and on went Lucille thumping away, until you wondered if he'd ever show up. And suddenly, there's a spotlight on the balcony, and the Reverend is alive. Reverend Pennyman. And the riff is on. So we learned their showmanship. After all, Little Richard was one of the best masters we could have learned from. I used this trick a lot with the expensive winos, where we'd black out the stage and the whole band would sit in a circle smoking a joint and having a drink. And people didn't know we were there. And then the lights go up and we break. That came from Little Richard. The Everly Brothers come out, and there's a soft light. The band plays very quietly. And their voices, that beautiful, beautiful refrain, almost mystical. Dream, dream, dream. Slipping in and out of unison and harmony. Loads of bluegrass in those boys. The best rhythm guitar playing I ever heard was from Don Everly. Nobody ever thinks about that, but their rhythm guitar playing is perfect and beautifully placed and set up with the voices. They were always very polite, very distant. I knew their band better. Joey Page, he was the bass player, Don Peake on guitar, and on drums was Jimmy Gordon, who was out of high school doing that. He was also Delaney and Bonnie's drummer and Derek and the Dominoes' drummer. Eventually, he hacked his mother to death in a schizophrenic rage and was sentenced to life in California. But that's another story. Later on, I knew that the Everlys were having problems that they always did. There was something a little analogous to Mick and me in that brotherhood. You've been through thick and thin, and then it gets really big, and you have the time and space to figure out what it is you don't like about each other. Yeah, more of that later on. There was an unforgettable dressing room scene during that tour. I liked Tom Jones. I first met him on that tour with Little Richard. I'd been on the road with Little Richard for 3 or 4 weeks, and Richard was not hard to get along with and still isn't, and we'd have a laugh together. But in Cardiff, guys like Tom Jones and his band, the Squires, were still living 5 years behind. They all walk into Little Richard's dressing room, and they've still got the leopard skin coats with the black velvet collars and the drapes, a procession of teddy boys all bowing and scraping. And Tom Jones actually kneels in front of Little Richard as if he's the Pope. And of course, Richard rises right to the occasion. My boys! They don't realize that Richard is a screaming fag. So they don't know how to take this. Well, baby, you're a Georgia peach. This total culture clash. But they were so in awe of Richard that they would take anything he would say. And he's given me a nod and a wink. I love my fans. I love my fans. Oh, baby. The Reverend Richard Pennyman. Never forget he comes from the Gospel Church, like most of them do. We all sang Hallelujah at one time or another. Al Green, Little Richard, Solomon Burke, they all got ordained. Preaching is tax-free, very little to do with God, a lot to do with money. Jerome Green was Bo Diddley's maracas shaker. He'd been with him on all the records, and he was sloppy drunk, one of the sweetest motherfuckers you could ever meet. He would just fall into your arms. He was almost Bo's partner. They'd been together through everything. There was a lot of call and response going on. Hey, man, your old lady's so ugly, I had to chase her away with an ugly stick. Jerome must have been an important part of Bo's life for Bo to keep him on. But the maracas were amazing. He used to play 4 in each hand, 8 maracas, very African. And the sound was incredible, pissed or not. That would be his thing. I can't go on. I'm not drunk. I took over the job of being Jerome's roadie for some reason. We liked each other a lot, and he was great fun. He was a big guy, looked a little like Chuck Berry. Suddenly there'd be this cry backstage. Anybody seen Jerome? And I'd say, I bet I know where he is. He'll be in the nearest pub from backstage. In those days, I wasn't that famous. People wouldn't recognize me. I'd zip round to the pub closest to the backstage, and there'd be Jerome, and he'd be talking to the locals, and they'd all be buying him drinks because they didn't often meet a 6-foot black man from Chicago. I was his minder. Jerome, you're on. Bo's looking for you. Oh, Christ, I'll be right back. By the end of the tour, he fell pretty ill. That's when I learned to call up doctors and get organized. I had him living at my apartment. I've given up on this English food, man. Where can I get some goddamn American food round here? I want a hamburger. So I go round Wimpy's to get him one. Call this a hamburger? Sorry, Jerome. In a way, I did it just because he was always such a laugh. And also, he really was such a charming guy. Didn't mind taking you for a few bucks either. But you felt if you weren't there, he'd fall under a bus or flush himself down the toilet if possible. He left Bo's band not long after this. That first tour was bizarre. I was never that confident about my own playing, but I knew that between us, we could do things and that there was something happening. We started off opening the show, and then we got to ending the intermission, and then we got to opening up the second half, and within 6 weeks, the Everly Brothers were virtually saying, "Hey, you guys better top the bill." Within 6 weeks. Something happened as we were going round England. The chicks started screaming. It was Teeny Boppers. And to us, being blues men, this was, well, we're really going downhill here. We don't want to be some fucking ersatz Beatles. Shit. We've worked this hard to be a very, very good blues band. But the money's better. And suddenly, with the size of the audience, like it or not, you're no longer just a blues band. You're now what they're going to call a pop band, which we despised. In a matter of weeks, we went from nowhere to London's crowning triumph. The Beatles couldn't fill in all of the spots on the charts. We filled in the gaps of the first year or so. You can put it down to Bob Dylan's "The Times They Are Changin'." You knew it. You sniffed it in the air, and it was happening fast. The Everly Brothers, I mean, I loved them dearly, but they smelled it too. They knew something was happening, and as great as they were, what are the Everly Brothers going to do when there's suddenly 3,000 people chanting, "We want the Stones, we want the Stones"? It was so quick. And Andrew Lou Goldham was the one that grabbed the moment. He was right on top of it. We knew that we'd set something on fire that I still can't control, quite honestly. All we knew was that we were on the road every day of the week. Maybe a day off here and there to get somewhere else, but we could tell from on the street, all over England and Scotland and Wales. 6 weeks ahead, you could feel it in the air. We got bigger and bigger and more crazy, until basically all we thought about was how to get into a gig and how to get out. The actual playing time was probably 5 to 10 minutes at max. In England for 18 months, I'd say we never finished a show. The only question was how it would end, with a riot, with the cops breaking it up, with too many medical cases, and how the hell to get out of there. The biggest part of the day was planning the in and out. The actual gig, you didn't even get to know much about. It was just mayhem. We came there to listen to the audience. Nothing like a good 10-15 minutes of pubescent female shrieking to cover up all your mistakes. Or 3,000 teenage chicks throwing themselves at you. Or being carried out on stretchers. All the bouffants awry. Skirts up to their waists. Sweating. Red. Eyes rolling. That's the spirit, girl. That's the way we like 'em. On the set list, for what it's worth, we had "Not Fade Away," "Walking the Dog," "Round and Round," and "I'm a King Bee." Sometimes chief constables would devise these ridiculous plans. I remember once in Chester, after a show that had ended in a riot, following the chief constable of Chester Police over the rooftops of Chester City, as in some weird Walt Disney film, with the rest of the band behind me, and him in full uniform with a constable at his side. And then he loses his fucking way, and we're perched on top of Chester City, while his great escape from Colditz plan disintegrates. Then it starts to rain. It was like something out of Mary Poppins. The uniform with the baton, the whole bit. And this was his great master plan. In those days, at my age, you thought the cops knew how to deal with everything. You were supposed to believe that. But you soon realized that these guys had never dealt with anything like this. It was as new to them as it was to us. We're all babes in the wood here. We used to play Popeye the Sailor Man some nights, and the audience didn't know any different because they couldn't hear us. So they weren't reacting to the music. The beat, maybe, because you'd always hear the drums, just the rhythm, but the rest of it, no. You couldn't hear the voices. You couldn't hear the guitars. Totally out of the question. What they were reacting to was being in this enclosed space with us. This illusion. Me, Mick, and Brian. The music might be the trigger, but the bullet, nobody knows what that is. Usually it was harmless for them, though not always for us. Amongst the many thousands, a few did get hurt, and a few died. Some chick, third balcony up, flung herself off, and severely hurt the person she landed on underneath, and she herself broke her neck and died. Now and again, shit happened. But the limp and fainted bodies going by us after the first 10 minutes of playing, that happened every night. Or sometimes they'd stack them up on the side of the stage because there were so many of them. It was like the Western Front, and it got nasty in the provinces, new territory for us. Hamilton in Scotland, just outside of Glasgow. They put a chicken wire fence in front of us because of the sharpened pennies and beer bottles they flung at us. The guys didn't like the chicks screaming at us. They had dogs parading inside the wire. The wire mesh was quite common in certain areas, especially around Glasgow at that time. But it was nothing new. You could see the same thing going on in clubs in the South, the Midwest. Midnight Hour, Mr. Wilson Pickett. His stage set consisted of a rack of shotguns this side and a rack of shotguns that side. And the shotguns weren't there as props. They were loaded. Probably with rock salt, no heavy-duty stuff. But to look at it was enough to put anybody off throwing things at the stage or going berserk. It was just a measure of control. One night, somewhere up north, it could have been York, could have been anywhere. Our strategy was to stay behind in the theater for a couple of hours and have dinner there, just wait for everybody to go to bed and then leave. And I remember walking back out onto the stage after the show, and they'd cleaned up all of the underwear and everything. And there was one old janitor, night watchman, and he said, "Very good show. Not a dry seat in the house." Maybe it happened to Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley. I don't think it had ever reached the extremes it got to around the Beatles and the Stones' time, at least in England. It was like somebody had pulled a plug somewhere. The 50s chicks being brought up all very jolly hockey sticks, and then somewhere, there seemed to be a moment when they just decided they wanted to let themselves go. The opportunity arose for them to do that, and who's going to stop them? It was all dripping with sexual lust, though they didn't know what to do about it. But suddenly, you're on the end of it. It's a frenzy. Once it's let out, it's an incredible force. You stood as much chance in a fucking river full of piranhas. They were beyond what they wanted to be. They'd lost themselves. These chicks were coming out there bleeding, clothes torn off, pissed panties, and you took that for granted every night. That was the gig. It could have been anybody, quite honestly. They didn't give a shit that I was trying to be a blues player. For a guy like Bill Perks, when suddenly there it is in front of you, it's unbelievable. We caught him in the coal pile with a chick, somewhere in Sheffield or Nottingham. They looked like something out of Oliver Twist. "Bill, we've got to go." It was Stu that found him. What are you going to do at that age when most of the teenage population of everywhere has decided you're it? The incoming was incredible. 6 months ago, I couldn't get laid. I'd have had to pay for it. One minute, No chick in the world. No fucking way. And they're going, la 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 la. And the next day they're sniffing around. And you're going, wow. When I changed from Old Spice to Habit Rouge, things definitely got better. So what is it they want? Fame? The money? Or is it for real? And of course, when you've not had much chance with beautiful women, you start to get suspicious. I've been saved by chicks more times than by guys. Sometimes just that little hug and kiss and nothing else happens. Just keep me warm for the night. Just hold on to each other when times are hard, times are rough. And I'd say, fuck, why are you bothering with me when you know I'm an asshole and I'll be gone tomorrow? I don't know. I guess you're worth it. Well, I'm not going to argue. The first time I encountered that was with these little English chicks up in the north on that first tour. You end up after the show at a pub or the bar of the hotel, and suddenly you're in the room with some very sweet chick who's going to Sheffield University and studying sociology who decides to be really nice to you. I thought you were a smart chick. I'm a guitar player. I'm just going through town. Yeah, but I like you. Liking is sometimes better than loving. By the late 50s, teenagers were a targeted new market, an advertising wind-up. Teenager comes from advertising. It's quite cold-blooded. Calling them teenagers created a whole thing amongst teenagers themselves, a self-consciousness. It created a market not just for clothes and cosmetics, but also for music and literature and everything else. It put that age group in a separate bag, and there was an explosion. A big hatch of pubescence around that time. Beatlemania and Stone Mania. These were chicks that were just dying for something else. Four or five skinny blokes provided the outlet, but they would have found it somewhere else. The power of teenage females of 13, 14, 15, when they're in a gang, has never left me. They nearly killed me. I was never more in fear for my life than I was from teenage girls. The ones that choked me, tore me to shreds, if you got caught in a frenzied crowd of them. It's hard to express how frightening they could be. You'd rather be in a trench fighting the enemy than to be faced with this unstoppable killer wave of lust and desire, or whatever it is. It's unknown even to them. The cops are running away, and you're faced with this frenzy of unleashed emotions. I think it was Middlesbrough, and I couldn't get in the car. It was an Austin Princess, and I'm trying to get in the car, and these bitches are ripping me apart. The problem is, if they get their hands on you, they don't know what to do with you. They nearly strangled me with a necklace. One grabbed one side of it, the other grabbed the other, and they're going, Keith, Keith. Meanwhile, they're choking me. I get hold of the handle, and it comes off in my hand, and the car goes zooming off, and I'm left with this goddamn handle in my hand. I got left in the lurch that day. The driver panicked. The rest of the guys had gotten in the car, and he just wasn't going to stick around any longer. So I was left in this pack of female hyenas. Next thing, I woke up in this back alley stage door entrance, because the cops had obviously moved everyone on. I'd passed out. I'd suffocated. They were all over me. What are you going to do with me now you've got me? I remember one scene of real contact with these girls, a completely unexpected moment, a vignette. The sky is sullen, it's a day off. Suddenly the storm breaks viciously. Outside, I see three diehard fans. Their bouffants are succumbing to nature's forces, but they stay. What can a poor boy do? Get in here, dopes. My tiny cubicle is filled with three drowned brats. They steam, trembling. They drench my room. The hairdos are done. They are trembling from the storm and from suddenly being in their, or one of their, idol's room. Confusion reigns. They don't know whether to squat or go blind. I'm equally confused. It's one thing to play on stage to them. It's another to be face to face. Towels become an important issue, as does the John. They make a poor attempt to resurrect themselves. It's all nerves and tension. I get them some coffee, laced with a little bourbon. But sex is not even in the air. We sit and talk and laugh until the sky clears. I get them a cab. We part as friends. September 1963. No songs. At least none that we thought would make the charts. Nothing in the ever-depleting R&B barrel looked likely. We were rehearsing at Studio 51 near Soho. Andrew had disappeared to walk about and absent himself from this gloom, and he'd walked into John and Paul, getting out of a taxi in the Charing Cross Road. They had a drink, and they detected Andrew's distress. He told them, no songs. They came back to the studio with him and gave us a song that was on their next album, but wasn't coming out as a single. I Want to Be Your Man. They played it through with us. Brian put on some nice slide guitar. We turned it into an unmistakably Stones rather than Beatles song. It was clear that we had a hit, almost before they left the studio. They deliberately aimed it at us. They're songwriters. They're trying to flog their songs. It's Tin Pan Alley. And they thought this song would suit us. And also, we were a mutual admiration society. Mick and I admired their harmonies and their songwriting capabilities. They envied us our freedom of movement and our image. And they wanted to join in with us. The thing is, with the Beatles and us, it was a very friendly relationship. It was also very cannily worked out, because in those days, singles were coming out every 6-8 weeks. And we'd try and time it so that we didn't clash. I remember John Lennon calling me up and saying, "Well, we've not finished mixing yet. We've got one ready to go. Okay, you go first." When we first took off, we were too busy playing on the road to think about writing songs. Also, we reckoned it wasn't our job. It hadn't occurred to us. Mick and I considered songwriting to be some foreign job that somebody else did. I rode the horse and somebody else put the shoes on. Our first records were all covers. Come On, Poison Ivy, Not Fade Away. We were just playing American music to English people, and we could play it damn good, and some American people even heard. We were already shocked and stunned to be where we were, and we were very happy as interpreters of the music that we loved. We thought we had no reason to step outside. But Andrew was persistent, strictly pressure of business. "You've got an incredible thing going here, but without more material, and preferably new material, it's over. You've got to find out if you can do that, and if not, then we've got to find some writers. Because you can't just live off cover versions." That quantum leap into making our own material, that took months. Though I found it a lot easier than I expected. The famous day when Andrew locked us in a kitchen up in Willesden and said, "Come out with a song," that did happen. Why Andrew put Mick and me together as songwriters and not Mick and Brian or me and Brian, I don't know. It turned out that Brian couldn't write songs, but Andrew didn't know that then. I guess it's because Mick and I were hanging out together at the time. Andrew puts it this way. "I worked on the assumption that if Mick could write postcards to Chrissy Shrimpton and Keith could play a guitar, then they could write songs. We spent the whole night in that goddamn kitchen. And I mean, we're the Rolling Stones, like the Blues Kings. And we've got some food. Piss out the window or down the sink. It's no big deal." And I said, "If we want to get out of here, Mick, we better come up with something." We sat there in the kitchen and I started to pick away at these chords. "It is the evening of the day." I might have written that. "I sit and watch the children play." I certainly wouldn't have come up with that. We had two lines and an interesting chord sequence, and then something else took over somewhere in the process. I don't want to say mystical, but you can't put your finger on it. Once you've got that idea, the rest of it will come. It's like you've planted a seed, then you water it a bit, and suddenly it sticks up out of the ground and goes, "Hey, look at me." The mood is made somewhere in the song. Regret, lost love. Maybe one of us had just busted up with a girlfriend. If you can find the trigger that kicks off the idea, the rest of it is easy. It's just hitting the first spark. Where that comes from, God knows. With As Tears Go By, We weren't trying to write a commercial pop song. It was just what came out. I knew what Andrew wanted. Don't come out with the blues. Don't do some parody or copy. Come out with something of your own. A good pop song is not really that easy to write. It was a shock, this fresh world of writing our own material. This discovery that I had a gift I had no idea existed. It was Blake-like, a revelation, an epiphany. As Tears Go By was first recorded and made into a hit by Marianne Faithfull. That was only weeks away. After that, we wrote loads of airy-fairy silly love songs for chicks and stuff that didn't take off. We'd give them to Andrew, and amazing to us, he got most of them recorded by other artists. Mick and I refused to put this crap we were writing with the Stones. We'd have been laughed out of the goddamn room. Andrew was waiting for us to come up with The Last Time. Songwriting had to be fitted in. After a show was sometimes the only time. It was impossible on the road. Stu would drive us, and he was merciless. We'd be stuck in the back of this Volkswagen, sealed in, one window at the back. And you sat on the engine. Most important was the gear, the amplifiers and the microphone stands and the guitars. And then, once that was loaded, wedge yourselves in. Find some room. And if you wanted to stop for a pee, forget about it. He'd pretend he couldn't hear you. And he had a huge stereo. Mobile sounds 40 years ahead of what they've got now. Two huge JBLs next to his ears in his driving cabin. A traveling prison. The Ronettes were the hottest girl group in the world. And in early 1963, they'd just released one of the greatest songs ever recorded, Be My Baby, produced by Phil Spector. We toured with the Ronettes on our second UK tour, and I fell in love with Ronnie Bennett, the youngest of the trio, who was the lead singer. She was 20 years old, and she was extraordinary to hear, to look at, to be with. I fell in love with her, silently, and she fell in love with me. She was as shy as I was, so there wasn't a lot of communication. But there sure was love. It all had to be kept very quiet because Phil Spector was, and notoriously remained, a man of prodigious jealousy. She had to be in her room all the time in case Phil called. And I think he quickly got a whiff that Ronnie and I were getting on, and he would call people and tell them to stop Ronnie seeing anybody after the show. Mick had cottoned to her sister, Estelle, who was not so tightly chaperoned. They came from a huge family. Their mother, who had six sisters and seven brothers, lived in Spanish Harlem, and Ronnie had first stepped out onto the Apollo stage when she was 11 years old. She told me later that Phil was acutely conscious of his receding hairline and couldn't stand my abundant barnet, London rhyming slang for hair, Barnet Fair. This insecurity was so chronic that he would go to terrible lengths to allay his fears, to the point where, after he married Ronnie in 1968, he made her prisoner in his California mansion, barely allowing her out and preventing her from singing, recording, or touring. In her book, she describes Phil taking her to the basement and showing her a gold coffin with a glass top, warning her that this was where she would be on display if she strayed from his rigorous rules. Ronnie had a lot